You're listening to a ComicsXF podcast.
WMQA.
Hello and welcome to WMQA, the ComicsXF interview podcast, where two best friends talk about comics with the people who make them. I'm Dan Grote.
And I'm Matt Lazowitz.
And this week's guest is the writer of DC's Blue Beetle, Josh Trujillo. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Josh, the last time we talked, it was FlameCon, and the weekend before the Blue Beetle movie opened. What did you think of it?
I'm incredibly biased, but I loved it. I saw it 3 times in theaters. I've watched it again on Max, but I really think it's good. I think it's a solid superhero family movie, and it's the kind of thing that, like, you don't need to know what's happening in Thanos' movie versus Rocket, you know, versus this, versus that. So it's very self-contained, and, like, the family aspect of it sold me really well, and so, like, I love it. I love Jaime. He's my guy. And I hope we get to see a lot more of him somewhere.
You've been writing Jaime's adventures for a bit more of a year's worth of comics, factoring in the miniseries. How excited were you to get to tell more stories after that initial miniseries wrapped?
Yeah, so the miniseries kind of came together after we participated in something called the DC Round Robin, which you're probably familiar with, but it was like a bracket style elimination tournament. And so fans would vote basically on which creative teams and characters they wanted to write. So we were up against some really tough books, but we made it to the semifinals. We got a lot of excitement there. And because we got to the semifinals, they let us produce the first 10 pages of what a first issue would look like. So just in case we made it to first place, they would have that half the issue ready already. We could get the ground running. We didn't win. So those 10 pages kind of just sat on a shelf for a while. And we thought that was the end of it. But with the movie coming back, DC wanted to kind of dust off Jaime and get some excitement around him again. So they asked if we could pick up the miniseries we'd already started, Blue Beetle Graduation Day. And with a few very surgical adjustments and tweaks, that's kind of how it came together. So that was about 2 or 3 years ago. And then the ongoing started in September, I want to say. So he's been a big part of my life for years now. And just the chance to tell new stories with Adrian Gutierrez, the artist, or Will Quintana, our colorist, or Lucas Gattoni, our all-star letterer, you know, that's the joy of it. We're one of the few books that have kept a full creative team, basically from its original run. It's rare to even have an issue where the artist sticks around the entire issue these days, it feels like. So for us to do, what is it now? We've been 13 issues of us is like a huge, huge feat and a testament to everyone's work ethic. Not mine. I'm the writer. I have the easy job.
You kind of segued right into what was going to be my next question about, you know, the fact that you've been working with this team from the beginning, and how has that collaboration sort of grown and expanded and changed over the course of a year plus's worth of story?
Yeah, I think we developed kind of a shorthand and an understanding of kind of what makes each other tick. You know, Adrian, I learn something new about his art style every page I get in, and it's amazing. I wake up to fresh pages from him, whether it's layouts or inks. And it's like every morning is like Christmas morning in that regard. But, like, you know, certain things I'm like, oh, I know Adrian's going to kill this one. Like, you know, I know Will's going to make this page really, really shine. And so it's nice to just call out in the script, just being like, Will, I want to do something like we did in issue 3 with this scene. Or Adrian, I'm going to ask you to draw the worst thing in the world. And I'm sorry, it's going to take up your week. And then Lucas and I have this love of logos that kind of is, you'll see if you read the book, whenever we introduce a super character, we usually use their logo. And so not just like Superman or whatever, but we use like in issue 7 of our Blue Beetle series, that's the Keith Giffen tribute. So Lucas dusted off some of these logos that haven't been used in like 40 years. And so that's fun for us. It's like pulling from the DC archives and making it feel like a cohesive package.
So Jaime is one of those heroes like the New Mutants and every Robin south of Nightwing whose stories are tied to the power of legacy. and sort of permanently being on the cusp of leaving the kids' table at Thanksgiving. Do you feel like with Legacy Heroes, it's gotten, easier or more difficult for them to gain traction when death is more of a revolving door? And so you don't have those same long stretches where like Barry Allen is dead for 20 years, or Hal Jordan is off being an evil parasite monster and also the Spectre. That happened.
It's a real thing. We don't talk about it enough. So yeah, with legacy characters, it's tricky now, right? Because we're on like our fourth or fifth Robin at this point. And so for you to like, you kind of have to squint, right? It's like, okay, so you were Robin for 3 months, you were Robin for 7 months, that sort of thing, right? But with Jaime, it's a little bit easier. He succeeded Ted Kord, who was dead, but he got better. So I think the challenge for us was Ted's been alive for a while and he's had a lot of fun interactions with Jaime, but I wanted to reestablish kind of what that relationship looked like for him. Legacy is like front and center for Blue Beetle. It's very much like what the book is about. It's about family, it's about legacy. It's about not just Jaime's legacy as the Blue Beetle, but also his Scarab Kajidaz history and kind of how they intertwine with each other. Because if something bad happens, it's usually Kajidaz's fault or something like that. So we're okay with it. I do agree that it's hard to see characters grow up given how dense the timeline is. But I think you just have to come up with creative solutions for it.
How has it been playing with mentor characters for Jaime? Because, I mean, initially, back in the day, in the original series, there was a very different version of Peacemaker than what we've gotten used to seeing
Oh,
over the
yeah.
course of the past few years. But now, with Ted back and also with Starfire, you've been playing with different mentor characters in Jaime's life, and how has that sort of come together, and how do each of them interact differently?
Yeah, Jaime has more mentors than just about anyone, I want to say. He's surrounded by his family members, whether it be his parents or his tias, Gloria and Marisol. But like, Ted is kind of that window to the Blue Beetle legacy, right? He's a part of that history of like, you came from these humble superhero beginnings and you're part of this greater DC superhero fabric. Whereas I look at Starfire as being kind of like space savvy and kind of can speak to his alien identity as much as his superhero identity. And so that's kind of where the lines are drawn in my head between Ted and Starfire. And they also have kind of different points of view on a lot of things. Ted's a little bit more of a white hat than Starfire is. I think people kind of forget that she has a lot of edge, especially if you read the classic New Teen Titans run. She is a fierce warrior, and I wanted to get back to some of that too. But it's so exciting to like get to use Starfire in particular. It's like she's on loan from a great museum or something, and we just get to play with her as much as we can. But I'm interested in exploring how those mentor dynamics shift as Jaime is kind of self-actualizing and forming his own identity and growing up. Is he going to grow past needing Ted Kord around? Is he going to go grow past needing Starfire? And I don't think we're anywhere near that, but I think given how powerful he is and how many ties he has to the DC universe, he's eventually going to have to stand on his own two legs.
You mentioned it before, but the most recent issue of Blue Beetle, issue 7 from now a couple weeks back, is a time-hopping tribute to recently deceased legend Keith Giffen. Giffen had a truly expansive career. Aside from his work with Jaime, what works of his have any special significance to you?
Yeah, I think if you read my Blue Beetle run, it's pretty clear that Justice League International was a big influence on the book, not just in terms of like the characters, obviously. Ted's in the book, Booster pops up in issue 7, of course, but also like the tone. I like a big cast. I like a rowdy cast that's bouncing off of each other. I like slow building storylines as much as we're able to tell them in the modern age. And I like that kind of like Keith had a really interesting kind of like pointedness. He wasn't afraid to pull punches, He had a little bit of, there's a little bitter streak kind of going through a lot of his writing that I think is like, it makes it funnier and it makes it have more edge to it. And so I'm not necessarily the edgy guy, but I think a lot of his humor and his heart is something I'm always trying to emulate. And then just with his Legion run in particular, that's a book that has, you know, you can't buy a sandwich if you're in the Legion of Superheroes by yourself. You have to have 75 Legion members out there with you, right? So like he could manage the biggest cast of all effortlessly and introduce all these new toys that they got to play with in the 80s and 90s. So I really respect his ability to pay reverence to the past and also pay irreverence to the past and adding a bunch of his new toys like Lobo or Ambush Bug.
You know, it occurs to me now that if the Legion, if Subway were still a thing in the 31st century and, you know, more importantly, the Subway Sub Club, they'd be filling those stamp cards like every day.
Oh, they would just buy the 12-foot subs, right? That would just be the easy.
As long as Matter Eater Lad wasn't around, because then they would just go way too fast one way or the other.
I'm just saying, that should pay for itself at that point. Was the Giffen tribute something that you pitched to DC or DC pitched to you, or did you guys both pitch it at the same time and it was super awkward but also kind of cute?
Well, so Keith Giffen passed the weekend of New York Comic Con, and he kind of famously, his family wrote his final post on Facebook, which was like anything to miss New York City Comic Con, which I think if you do enough of these conventions, you understand why you'd rather be dead than be on the show floor sometimes. But, he had a remarkable wit, and when he passed away, I knew I wanted to be a part of whatever DC was planning. I didn't know if they were going to do a tribute book or just do some quotes in, like, you know, in the back matter of various issues. But he was such a standout creator, not just for me, but a lot of like my contemporaries. I'm thinking of Joanne Starr, who did the Fire and Ice book. That's very Keith Giffen-y. And also Jadzia Axelrod, who did Hawk Girl. You know, these are kind of modern creators who are taking their lessons from Keith. And so I didn't know what it was going to be, but maybe about a month later, my editor, Andrew Marino, he was really passionate about doing something nice for Keith too. And he's like, you know, we've been talking about doing a Booster Gold issue. Why don't we fold that into the Keith Giffen issue? And then we started to bounce around ideas and doing kind of like a time romp, visiting all these eras and characters that he had such a hand in, seemed like the best way to do it. So it's kind of a happy marriage of kind of us wanting to do something special for Keith and also kind of having the right story to tell it with him. We were in the middle of our Scarab War arc, so we knew we had to wait a couple months. But I think that actually gave us more time to kind of think it out and make it feel a little more cohesive than it might have.
And I will say, just as sort of an aside, I feel like DC especially does a great job when these older creators pass on of making the tribute stand out. I think, you know, this Blue Beetle number 7 is a perfect example, but even just sort of in you know, the ads isn't the right word, but, you know, in the back of issues, we're having these like 2-page tributes when artists pass on. I'm thinking Neil Adams recently, Denny O'Neill.
George Perez.
George Perez, of course, George Perez.
The story that Denny's son wrote that was at the back of the Green Arrow 80th anniversary that was also a tribute to Denny was a...
That was a tearjerker.
Yeah, yeah. And when they circled back and re-released the story Kevin Conroy wrote for the Pride special.
Oh my gosh. I was about to bring that one up. That was a heartbreaking one. But I do think that DC understands that they are in the legacy business of not just the characters, but also the creators. And, you know, it took them a long time. I think the current management would agree. It took them a long time to pay proper reverence to writers and creators like Bill Finger or even the Schusters. And, I think the goal is always to do right by their creators today.
So you pulled together a lot of disparate threads from Giffen's career for this issue: the Legion, JLI, Lobo, Ambush Bug, Johnny DC, the continuity cop. Were there any that were harder to fit in, or that you just couldn't fit in?
Oh gosh, you know, the one that I wanted to use, because we had Howard Porter do the Legion sequence for us, and that was a big treat. And Howard worked on, I want to say, Justice League 3000 with Keith. And that was a really special book. So I was hoping if we, you know, that's the curse of a comic book, right? If we only had more pages. But the Justice League 3000 nod would have been a lot of fun for me. And I wanted to do something in the 52 era, because I don't think Keith gets enough credit for what he did during 52. He was one of the writers to a smaller degree, but what he did was he broke down the pages of the script so that the art team could move as fast as possible. So he did all the layouts for every issue of 52. And that's so much storytelling just alone. And he loves a 6-panel grid, and he figured out how to master it during that book. So those were the two ones. I think Justice League 3000 and something in set during 52. But I have hope that I'll get to return to 52 at some point. It's my favorite book.
Johnny DC rightly points out that the continuity of Blue Beetle as a concept has been, let's say, tangled over the years. You know, I'm not quite Hawkman levels of confusing,
but, sure.
You know, between the Scarabs and the aliens and the Pharaohs and whatnot, you know, I could see where she's coming from. How did you feel taking on Jaime, given all of that history? Because it seems like you're reveling in it, to be quite honest.
Oh, I have so much fun going through the back issues and reading old, like, Len Wein, Ted Kord issues, or reading the Steve Ditko, Ted Kord stuff. And, like, I love pulling bits and bobbles from the past. But I think for Jaime, the question I got the most when I started to talk about doing the character, like, during the round robin competition, was, okay, is the Scarab magic, or is the Scarab technology? Because we've seen both versions of it presented over the various reboots and rehashes of the character. And my answer to that is yes. He's all the things. Anything that makes Jaime more central to the DC universe, I think, is a good thing, even if it's a little messy at times. But I have a headcanon that kind of manages his sci-fi alien roots, but also kind of this mystical legacy that surrounds the Scarab from the very beginning. And we touch on some of that in the Scarab War arc. The villain who reappears is a magic-based villain, and they are the first Blue Beetle villain of all Blue Beetle villains. And so that was a lot of fun for me to kind of find that character from the back issues and make them a modern threat.
I'm going rogue with a question here that just popped into my head.
Yeah.
I could not get over when I learned this a few years ago that, you know, Superman has a long history on classic Golden Age radio. Mm-hmm. Batman never had his own radio show, but Dan Garrett did.
Oh yeah, he was a big hit.
Yeah, have you ever heard, I've heard one, but have you ever heard any of those old Dan Garrett Blue Beetle radio shows?
I listened to one, because I think the original version was not really Kaji Dot based. He was just like a shadow knockoff, to be honest. And that's what everyone was doing. Batman's a knockoff of the Shadow. Like, it's fine. But, like, those were really interesting. I would love to pull from that kind of lore at some point, even if it would only please the one person who listens to Golden Age Blue Beetle podcast like yourself. But there are a couple of really funny moments from those older comics that I'm trying to find a place for. But, it's funny how he's always been kind of a multimedia star. Like, he crossed over from radio to comics, and now he's in movies and video games and TV shows. He's always had his eye kind of all over the place.
He probably appeared in more episodes of Batman the Brave and the Bold than any other hero, with maybe the exception of John DiMaggio's hilarious Aquaman interpretation. Mm-hmm. But it was those two were the ones who popped up more than anybody else, because he was an excellent choice there as the POV character, as the young hero. He was in the pilot.
Yeah, he's great in that. And his arc in Young Justice is probably one of the best Blue Beetle stories. Definitely S tier. And then I really like actually what they do with the characterization of him in the Injustice video games. And there's even in the Injustice comic book that Tom Taylor wrote, there's some great Booster and Jaime stuff going on there too. So he's always been bigger. I always think of him, he's much more than the comic book, but please keep reading the comic book.
So how was working with all the different artists on this issue? Did you have to do a lot different in terms of scripting to tailor from, one artist to the next?
A little bit. So, I know Adrian's style pretty well. And so that was easy. And it was nice to give him a little bit of a break for the month to only do, I think, 5 pages in that cover, which you would think he would have spent a month on it because it has so many characters in it. He drew it in like a day. He's like, I have an idea for a cover. I'm going to drop it off tomorrow. And I'm like, okay. And they dropped it off. And we're like, how did you do this? How are you so talented? But for example, with the, I wanted to pull kind of from the artistic style and the writing style of the different eras. So for Justice League International, we have Maxwell Lord who appears, not the evil gun-toting Max so much, more of our classic befuddled businessman guy. And so we have a long page, and Natasha Bustos does some classic eye-rolling expressions from Max and kind of drawing from Kevin Maguire in a big way. And then for the Howard Porter Legion sequence, most of that book, the original Legion run that Keith Giffen did, is almost all 9-panel grids. He wrote so densely. There is so much story in each issue. It feels like an entire arc you get sometimes. And so that was a real lesson for me because I don't like to do more than 5 or 6 if I can help it. But to write for 9 panels and also like the transitions between panels are really interesting. So I learned a lot about like what works for me and what works for the artist, I want to say in that. And then with Scott Collins, who did kind of our outside of time segment with Lobo, I'll just like get as weird as you want with it. Like that's the spirit of the event, right? And then I don't have to tell Coley Hamner how to draw Blue Beetle. So whatever layout you want, sir, you are the king. So that was maybe my favorite part though, with getting Coley back for a few pages and setting it in El Paso.
I'm curious, back before, obviously, did you ever get a chance to talk to Keith Giffen before his passing about Jaime or anything else? Any memorable encounters with comics' greatest curmudgeon?
Oh man, I wish. There's that Simpsons episode where Homer confesses that he had the chance to meet Mr. T at the mall, but never got the chance to do it. And so that's kind of been like my white whale was like hoping to see Keith at a convention. But by the time I think he was East Coast based or Midwest based, and he just simply wasn't making public appearances by the time that I was kind of starting to do Blue Beetle. So I definitely missed that. I got to see Kevin Maguire the other week at Emerald City Comic Con, and he did a variant cover for issue 7, which was very special to me. It features Ted Kord and Ambush Bug together. And I was just like, you don't understand what a big deal it is. You drew for something that I made. Like that is like the biggest compliment, the biggest wow moment I could have possibly had. And I definitely encourage people to like shake the hands of the people who made such a big difference for you. This is kind of a sad story, but I'm gonna tell it anyway. So Jerry Robinson, who co-created the Joker, was at San Diego Comic-Con maybe like 10 or 11 years ago, and he was in poor health, but he was still there to meet fans. He wasn't signing anything, but he was handing out like he was selling lithographs, I think, with his signature on them. And the way that people just walked by that table, completely unaware that someone who basically invented comic book villains was sitting right there made me so sad. And I went out of my way to like talk to him for a few minutes and really thank him for everything he did. But so many people didn't, and I bet they didn't even realize he was there. So if you're ever at a convention and someone you look up to is there, like I think I've not been that person to someone yet, but reach out to them, let them know how special their work was.
Matt, Keith used to shop at Dewey's, didn't he?
Oh yeah, he was New North Jersey based. I worked at the comic shop where he
Really?
shopped for a number of years. He was always a hoot. He would come in and you're like, okay, A, when Keith walked in, A, you knew you were in for at least half an hour of him just being curmudgeonly and never spoke ill of a person. He was always very cordial, but he would, what they're doing. And you never brought up Lobo just because it was like, they never got, they don't get what I was trying to do. I mean, sometimes when he was doing the 52, and sometimes when people were treating Lobo as the comedic character that he was supposed to be, he was sometimes was like, they don't get it. He's supposed to be a You know, he's a parody. You don't, he's not supposed to be taken seriously. He was always such a hoot. He was one of, I mean, we had a handful of creators from that era. Bob Wyachek, John Ostrander, all shopped with us at different points or another.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, but yeah, Keith was with us for a number of years. I mean, it helped that it was the local store to the Kubert School. So, you know, we also had all the Kubert alums and all the faculty shopped with us regularly too.
Oh, that's amazing. He had a podcast last year, 2 years ago. It was only had three episodes that he started, and it was called I'm Not Dead Yet. And I listened to that Legion one he did because he answered some fan questions, I think, about the Legion of Superheroes run he did. And I listened to that like multiple times, like, what did you like about these characters? Like, what is your, like, what is the mark you wanted to leave on them? And that's like, if you ask any creator that, they'll just like completely freeze into place and think really long and hard about it.
That title is just, yeah, that absolutely spot on fit the sense of humor that he had. Oh, yeah.
So you mentioned having an affinity for the JLI. Was there any trepidation or nervousness for you, you know, when you first got to put those characters in a room together in a script, given how much nostalgia there is for that specific combination of superheroes?
Yeah, you know, that's a tall order. That's like the big book for me, I think, on the DC. It's like that and 52, which both happen to have Keith involved, and obviously a lot of Grant Morrison stuff I love. But, you know, I was nervous, but I knew that given the page size constraints we had, we only had a few pages to go to this era. I wanted to focus on one of his creations instead of trying to do the grab bag, everyone in the clown car kind of situation. And so I focused on Max, because I think his original conception of Max was so interesting. It's also so different than kind of what we know of him today. If you like, you know him as the guy who killed Ted Kord. And this now he's a big, you know, big tier Wonder Woman villain. And like, I just wanted to get back kind of like the rude businessman, the power suit kind of guy. And I was nervous, but I knew that we had Natasha Bustos on board. And that Fire and Ice mini that she did with Joanna Starr is like, Keith could have written it himself. It is funny. It is mean. It is heartfelt. And it uses a lot of his best creations, including Lobo and Ambush Bug. So I knew that Natasha could draw whatever I could come up with. I just needed to make sure that I could write as good as she could draw.
an issue like number 7, you know, this All-Star Jam standalone story tribute issue is obviously, you know, you wanted to get more eyes on the book. Maybe older lapsed readers, maybe new ones who heard it was a big deal, you know, wherever they're coming from. Was there a plan or discussion about how to kind of seize on the momentum that it might create going into the next arc?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I definitely thought about how I wanted the issue to feel self-contained enough for new readers or people who were there just kind of to pay tribute to Keith. I wanted that to be a fulfilling reading experience. But because of everything that had happened in the Scarab War arc, there were a lot of things we needed to address directly. And so we tried to make a couple scenes, like draw attention to what Jaime was going through. And he doesn't come through the other side completely healed following the events of Scarab War. It's going to be haunting him coming up more. But like that sequence in El Paso that Cully drew is really special to me. And I think it kind of crystallizes a lot of what I loved about his run on the character, and also kind of conveniently gave Jaime someone to talk to about what had happened in Scarab War. And obviously we end issue 7 with a bit of a teaser for what the next arc is going to entail. And it features one of our new Beatles, Roma, our Green Beetle Natitha, and kind of the decision she makes that's going to impact the rest of the cast and completely blow up Jaime's life. Because he's the main character. He can't be happy.
Spider-Man logic applies even at DC. Yeah. So and so Natitha is a good segue, because you have now a whole sort of rainbow of these Sentai-influenced, Scarab-infused characters. What is your favorite era of Power Rangers?
You know, that's the funniest thing, is I'm not the big Sentai guy. Adrian is. So I grew up with the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers and VR Troopers and all the kind of like honestly just like whatever it was Saban shoveled onto TV screens in the 90s was the stuff that I knew really well. So my loyalty is kind of with those warts and all English translations of the early Sentai stuff. Adrian's a huge Kamen Rider fan. I think if you know Kamen Rider and you see any of his designs, you see a direct like this kid grew up watching Dragon Ball Z and Akira Toriyama and Kamen Rider and Gundam and all these greats. And so I will say my favorite Power Ranger is the second Black Ranger in the US, who's Adam. I thought he was cool. But the Black Rangers have always been my favorite. I like the Mastodon and I like that aesthetic on the costume. But once this ends someday, I want to really get into the Sentai stuff. My big fear was that I was going to be accidentally incepting stuff if I watched it. So I was like, let's just go in blank and we'll do our version of our stuff. And then when I'm done with Blue Beetle someday, then I can become the Kamen Rider fan. I know I already am.
There's a page in issue. I think it's five. Obviously, please correct me if I'm wrong, but it recreates the origin or sort of retells the origin of the first Blue Beetle, Dan Garrett, in that Golden Age style, but ties it into the origin of the Blood Scarab, the villain of the first arc. How did that page come together?
So my original plan was to do a flashback and present it as original, like a new story set within that time period. But the more I kept reading back issues and the more I started to kind of figure out what the Blood Scarab's deal was, how he was Ka-F Rey, this evil sorcerer pharaoh, and that ties back to the original Dan Garrett appearance in the Silver Age. So I saw this page of him fighting a mummy and burying the mummy in a tomb. And I was like, oh, this is actually exactly what I wanted. Why bother making up a new sequence when this exists? So I showed the panels to Adrian and he's like, oh yeah, I can draw in this style, no problem. And so he did that. So it's all pages from the original or panels from the original comic, but we added three new panels at the bottom of the page to kind of add some context to how Ka-F Rey became the Blood Scarab. And he drew that in the same style. But it's fun to pick up a 2024 comic and then tie into things that happened in like 1962. And that's the fun of comics for me. And then Lucas, our letterer, did everything in like a classic lettering style. So it feels like you're reading like a sunburnt comic page, from the back issues of the 60s or 70s.
Of all the supporting cast in the series so far, and as you mentioned, it is a large supporting cast. I think my personal favorite is Victoria Cord, Ted's sister. She's this cold presenting, queer, sapiosexual, giving huge Emma Frost vibes. Dresses conservatively but still fashionably in this fun and a gender bendy way. The scene with where she gets all the flowers from Lex Luthor, 10 out of 10, no notes. It's just, it's such a statement of telling us exactly who she is. I reckon I got to the end of this and realized I haven't asked a question, but I whatever, my statement stands. She's great.
Oh, I love Victoria. She is always at risk of eating up the entire comic whenever she appears. And I didn't create her. She was created for the movie, and I got to introduce her with Adrian into the comic books. But we didn't know what she was going to be like. We didn't have a script to go off of, or we didn't have scenes. The movie hadn't come out yet. And so I just kind of figured out like, how do you do a brilliant female scientist without making them Lex Luthor in a pantsuit? And that's always been the challenge with Victoria Cord, because there are great, brilliant female villains out there. I'm thinking of like Veronica Kale from Wonder Woman, or I'm thinking of oh my gosh, I'm blanking on her name. She's the villain of the recent Hawk Girl mini. It's like with Jatea.
Vulpecula?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so there are a lot of strong characters in that in a similar vein. It's like what makes her different is like she is very pragmatic, I would say. I think a lot of what she does is out of pragmatism and her being the smartest woman in the room. And it's kind of hard. I don't think of her as a villain in any way, but she's definitely an antagonist to Jaime's life in a lot of ways. And my thing was, how do you justify a, we'll say 40-something, 30-something billionaire who's brilliant, like this, maybe the smartest woman in the DC earth, and why does she care about Jaime, who's like a teenager that is totally indecisive and this and that? And so building up that relationship between the two of them is a lot of fun for me, and kind of getting to a point where you realize that they're both like, they both kind of want the same exact things, but man, do they not agree on any way to do that?
So it's funny because, you know, Dan focused on the Lex Luthor scene, and I too had a note from there that I wanted to just mention, since in the her spiel in that scene, she also mentions one of DC's other Victorias.
Yes.
The vastly forgotten and underrated Victoria October, a bat supporting character and one of DC's few, although slowly increasing, canonically trans characters. I know you can't give away spoilers, but I just have to say, as the bat nerd in me, that is a character that I would love to see pop up again somewhere, because that was a great character.
Oh, I love that character that James created. And what I love about her is she loves monsters. And so Victoria Cord, is she a monster? I don't know. We'll see where she lands. But I love that character. And I think there's a lot more story that can be told, I think, with Victoria Cord's love life and also Victoria October and how that might intersect between the two of them. I wanted to find a way, because I always knew Victoria Cord was going to be queer. And I wanted to do that as a nod, not just to the actress, Susan Sarandon, who is bisexual, but also to just fill out Jaime's cast with a realistic portrayal of queer life. And so, yeah, I love Dr. October. It was a fun call out. And I would love to do a Victoria Valentine's Day special or something like that.
So we're talking here, and you've said it before, that this is such a big cast. I mean, and from all of Jaime's history, I mean, you have Paco and Brenda from the original run, Ted, who came in for Thera, you're adding the Tias, the Horizon, Victoria, the New Beatles. How much planning for you goes into keeping the book balanced and not losing track of all these characters, so you don't go 4 months before it's like, oh, right, and then there's this character?
Right, that's the big challenge, right? And so that's something I picked up, hopefully I picked up from like Chris Claremont's X-Men or Keith and J.M. DeMatteis's and Kevin Maguire's Justice League International. But I like a big cast that bounce off of each other. And also Jaime's book is so much about family. It's not the same if there's no family involved. And so for me, that meant a found family in the way of his friends, Paco and Brenda and the New Beatles. But of course, his traditional family, his parents, Milagro, his sister, and his tias, Gloria and Marisol now. But it's something I try to be very careful with it. I try to give everyone something to do, not every issue, but they're all kind of building towards the central thing about Jaime. And everything they're doing is in service to Jaime's story. But it's exciting to get like an action sequence with Brenda or something like that. Because it's like, I love a supporting cast, and Jaime has the best supporting cast in comics. I just want to fill up the toy box with as many toys as I can until it overflows.
On top of all that, tricks. You've got this, you know, you bring in a whole other legacy by bringing in a Pemberton. Where did the use of a fairly obscure Morrison creation sort of come from?
Yeah, so you know, Gimmicks is a Grant Morrison creation. She's the heir to marry the Gimmicks girls, kind of a bag of tricks. She was like a, you know, she appeared in Mary appeared in more Golden Age comics than Robin did. And so she's second only to Batman and Superman. So she's like, really, that's the Trinity of the Golden Age. But she was just some girl with a bag of like, oh, it's chewing gum, but it's also explosive, or it's this, or it's that. And so anyway, Grant came up with this kind of like very cynical take on that character in the Jacqueline Pemberton, the modern version of gimmicks. And so she died famously in her first appearance. I think she's introduced on page 2 and she dies on page 12 or something like that. And so it just, it might just be the gay in me, but every time I talk to someone about Seven Soldiers, everyone's like, you know, who was cool in Seven Soldiers? And we all say gimmicks. And she had 2 appearances up to this point. So I knew that she was destined for great things because she was so memorable. And it was a happy coincidence because we use the bag of tricks that she wields in Graduation Day in issue 4. It's kind of the whole thing where there's a heist in Cord Tower, and the whole heist is about getting that bag. So I knew I wanted to pay that off in some way. And when I found out we were going to get to do what I thought was another miniseries, it turned out to be an ongoing, I saw a perfect opportunity to resurrect a redhead. And that's kind of where she came into the picture. But you know, her original thing is utility belt type gimmicks. But now, because of maybe her interactions with the Cheetah and Seven Soldiers, her bag is now magic. And so that leads to a whole other host of questions about where she came from, and is she a manifestation of the bag at this point? And so I love Jaime as a character who's saddled with this legacy of inherited power. And Fadeaway, who we also introduced in Graduation Day, is the modern version of the Fadeaway Man, and who also has an inherited power. And so for gimmicks, it's just another one. And I think the more we see that kind of trope, the more we learn about Jaime as well.
And I do know her name is Gimmicks. I don't know why it came out as Tricks, but
no, because it's the bag of tricks.
Yeah, exactly. And they're not for kids. Now, Chimera City was created for the Blue Beetle movie in the same way that Victoria was, but you got to introduce them first in a, you know, long line of great characters created, and great queer characters actually created for other media who then move over to the DC universe, you know, the Montoya. But you got to flesh out Chimera City. What makes it different and special, say, from Gotham or Metropolis or Opal? And how does it feel to add to that canon of these fascinating fictional DC cities?
Yeah, you know, it was really exciting. I think in the Valentine's Day special they did recently, Booster Gold's story is set in Palmera City. And I was like, oh, that's like, that never occurred to me that other people would write in Palmera City. Not that I want to own it, but like, it's just been our special place. But, you know, Palmera City is kind of what I call a Silicon Valley on the Gulf Coast. It's on the east side of Texas. In my head, it's somewhere between Corpus Christi and Houston. If you know anything about geography, I don't. But it's kind of, what if this town with a lot of like historic roots kind of in Latino culture and diversity in a bilingual society suddenly became a Silicon Valley? And you've got that old world, that old vibes, and then you have this high-tech center of it, which is really personified by Victoria Cord. And so that was cool. We saw a little bit of concept art, I will say, before the movie came out. So we had an idea. We're like, in the movie, it's very clearly Miami. But in ours, I think it's more, I wanted to stay in Texas, but there's not a map. We'll get a map someday, maybe. But as far as I'm concerned, it's in the Gulf Coast of Texas. And it has a unique flavor and a unique flair and vibrancy that Gotham simply doesn't. Gotham is a very stark, contrasting city. Metropolis is a very bright utopia. And I think Palmera is a city kind of in conflict with its tradition versus this new wave of tech. And how do you modernize without sacrificing that legacy? And that's very much what Jaime's struggle is too. So I think it fits pretty well for what he's going through. Even though it's not a major center point of the book, we always try to filter in new locations for Palmera City, a little bit of placemaking. And if you are ever bored, you can look up what the location names are in Palmera City. They're all named after former Blue Beetle creators, whether it be Jimenez Street, which is kind of our take on Alvera Street, Or we have the Soto Science Center, which is a nod to the director of Blue Beetle, Manuel. And so just little things like that. It's a lot of love that goes into the city. And I hope that other creators pick it up, not just Blue Beetle creators. I hope that whoever moves in, Metamorpho, you're welcome here.
One thing that stands out to me is the way Lucas, your letterer in the book, handles whispering. He creates these sort of light gray dashed borders around the dialogue. Mm-hmm. Did I read correctly? He handles both the English and Spanish translations of the book.
Yeah, Lucas is the only letterer I know. I'm sure someone does it somewhere else, but only one I know in the world who letters a book in two languages. And so he letters the English version and also the Spanish translation that's translated by, we have a team that does that. And they do an incredible job of making the dialect neutral enough that any Spanish reader can appreciate it. And so sometimes Lucas will also have like a little note about like the translation as well. I'm like, well, if you say it like this, it kind of means more like this. And you know, the little things like that. So he's our last line of defense, I want to say, as far as the language goes. But he's so talented. He knocks it out of the park every single time. And the way that he does, not just the logos, but, you know, I fill up the script with a lot of moments of like, you know, Jaime says this to himself. And so he'll do the small gray ellipses, or Victoria's dominating and bossy. And I'm thinking a Devil Wears Prada vibe. And then he'll come up with this beautiful pink commanding font that kind of fits the scene very well. And so like, it's very much literally the sound effects. The sound of our book comes from Lucas, and he does such a wonderful job of capturing kind of the cartoonishness we love. It is a comic book, but also the serious moments, I think he grounds them really well. In issue 7, he has like 5 different art teams to deal with. And if his lettering really makes it feel cohesive all the way through, my original idea was let's do the lettering styles the way that the original books did in each era. And he's like, that's insane. No. And that was the right call. It's good to have someone who knows you well enough to say, absolutely not.
Absolutely.
What non-spoilery things can you tease about what's coming up for Jaime?
Yeah. So, you know, Roma or Natita makes a big decision in issue 7 at the end of it. And that's going to spill over not just to Jaime, but basically to every character in our cast. We're going to see a lot more of Victoria. We're going to see a lot more of Brenda in particular. And we're going to see a new character appear called Pinnacle. And they are working for Victoria. They are a new kind of hero. And they are exactly as effective as you would think they would be if Victoria Cord wanted to build a superhero. It's not good news for Jaime. It might be good news for Palmera City, but it's not good news for Jaime.
So we did get a couple of Twitter questions, and I'll pepper those in here. First, Robin Quinn asked, other than Jaime, who is your favorite member of the Reyes family?
Oh, okay. So hi, Robin. Robin's a longtime fan, so thank you. I like Milagro, his sister. She's easily my biggest regret so far in writing the book is that there's just not a place for her because we're doing this like far from home kind of storyline. He's branching out, he's building his own identity and his new supporting cast. So we don't get to do a lot of Milagro stuff. I miss her. And I actually like, of his two Tias, Gloria is actually named after my grandma. She ran a diner. She runs a restaurant in Orange County. And so the restaurant named after her husband, but I named the diner and the comic after her. And so anyway, I have a special fondness for Gloria. And then Marisol, just named Marisol because I thought it was a pretty name, but I like her a lot. I have a big story that I don't know, I hope we'll get to between the two of them and kind of how they relate to the Reyes family. But honestly, DC has been so accepting and cool about it. Like, I want to introduce his lesbian aunt. And they're like, absolutely. And then Adrian was so excited to draw them too. Every time he pops up, they pop up on the page. He's always like, it's so good to draw them again. Cause you know, they're middle-aged women who don't have superpowers. So there's not a lot of time for them to get in the middle of the action. But every time we do, we use them very effectively, I think.
And then our grand Twitter inquisitor, Asimov Fangirl, asked, as the movie version of Blue Beetle taught us, everything is better with Buster Swords. So which character from your cast would be improved if they started using one?
Oh, gosh. I think Victoria would be the one, right? She, if she just brought that to the boardroom, it would be over. But also, she doesn't need... She's a pen is mightier than the sword kind of girl, too. I keep thinking about giving a character a weapon, like a signature weapon, and we may get there. But I do think about making the toys cooler, and I think a Buster Sword is always the way to go. I told Adrian in one of the issues, I think it was when they were fighting the Blood Scarab in issue 6, I was like, let's do something cool. Like, maybe we do the Buster Sword. And he's like, no, I got something better than the Buster Sword. And so that's where that 2-page spread came from. That like really like panel by panel brutal fight between the Blood Scarab and Hajida and Jaime. So, you know, you ask for a Buster Sword, sometimes you get something even better than a Buster Sword.
Right when we talked last at FlameCon, your graphic biography of the Baron von Steuben with Levi Hastings, Washington's gay general, had just been released. How's the response to that book been?
It's been wildly positive, as much as I can tell. What do you guys know? But I'm just kidding. It's been really doing really well for them. I know it's gotten multiple printings already. And people have just reached out and been so kind about the book, because it's not just a graphic novel biography of this Revolutionary War general, von Steuben, who was gay. It's really an exploration of kind of queer identity through history. And also, what is queer history when we don't have those labels that go that far back? You know, the term homosexual didn't exist until the 1800s, long after von Steuben had died. And our understanding of gender and love and marriage and sexuality, they're all so different than they were in the Revolutionary Age. So a lot of that book is unpacking what that means. And it's been such a pleasure to do. Levi and I are circling our follow-up, which is not Revolutionary War themed, but that's not to say we'll never return to that era. We're just interested by like fascinating figures through queer history and trying to give them a little bit more spotlight. I got to go to some of the historic sites that he lived when I was debuting that book last year after FlameCon. I had help from the Daughters of the American Revolution's Brooklyn's chapter, and they took me to one of the houses he lived in New Jersey. And it was so interesting because I had planned to visit a lot of these sites when I was writing the book, but it happened to be right when the pandemic started, so I couldn't do any travel. But thanks to them, I was able to see these sites and really get added context. I got to see some of his personal belongings, and I also got to hold his sword, which was cool. I went to the Yale Museum of Art, and they're like, do you want to hold his sword? And I was so delicate and careful with it. They're like, Josh, it's made of solid metal. You couldn't break this thing if you wanted. And I'm like, okay, I'm so sorry. I don't want to break the sword. So that was cool. Yeah, it's been such a positive experience, and I'm not a historian by trade, although maybe now I am. But I think if it's, I hope it encourages people to kind of look in their own family histories or just find people who gravitate towards and try to get as much information out of that and share it as you can.
Where, you talked about it a little bit there, but where did the idea to not do this as a straight biography, pun sure, completely intended, versus this more holistic look at queer history with von Steuben as sort of the spine of the story come from? How did that develop?
Yeah, you know, we had some incredibly smart editors. We have Mariko Tamaki, who's very well known as a graphic novel writer, writes for television, writes for everything. And we also had Charlotte Greenbaum, who's our editor over at the Shirley imprint we're a part of. Every time I turn in a draft, they would say to me, we love it, but we want to see more of you in the script. And I'm like, well, you know, like it's a very personal story. It's about like kind of yearning towards greatness. It's about like the shortcomings that happen along the way. It's about queer identity. And they're like, no, we literally want to see you and Levi in the book. So that's where we started to figure it out, where we are in the book as basically characters who are navigating some of these more complicated questions about what does the queer identity mean 300 years ago? And so that was a little nerve-wracking for me, because I am a semi-public guy because I do comics and I go on podcasts and stuff, but like I'm never in the book. And so like that was a little scary, but it honestly, I think it made people connect with it a little bit better to have a point of view character who is asking these same questions alongside the reader.
And you talk about it in the book, and you talked about it a bit before, but it's one of the most important things you say, and I'd love to hear you expound on it a bit more. What is it about telling stories like the Barons, like these queer people from history, that is so important right now?
Yeah, I think especially now, it's not hard to find news stories about book bannings or even book burnings happening in the United States. People, librarians getting fired, teachers getting fired, laws being passed to prevent people from sharing books like Genderqueer by Maya Cobain. And that's a real problem. You know, it originally the goal was just to draw attention to the fact that we've always been there. You know, there's that kind of like that common myth of Stonewall happened and suddenly there were gay people. And it's like, well, actually, if you go a little bit further back, go a little bit, you keep going back, you're going to find us. It's not that hard. And that was originally the goal. But, you know, once I realized that in learning about other queer history stories, how much of a privilege it is to have your story be written into the history at all. And for every von Steuben, who is this great military general, we have infinite people who we just don't, we'll never know their story. We don't know what frontline soldiers in the Revolutionary War. There were probably a lot of queer men fighting in that war. There were women who were cross-dressing and fighting in that war. And we talk about one of them in the book. And so like, I think now it's about establishing our history collectively and protecting it is now the cause. You know, it's one thing to dig up the history, but it's another thing to share it. And it's another thing to keep it available to people. And so like, thankfully there are things you can do now. Anyone in the country can sign up for a New York Public Library card, and they have so many online resources and so many eBooks and things you could buy or could just check out for free. And so like, I'd encourage people to find those communities where kind of queer art and queer history and queer everything exists and kind of build that community out. Cause we might not be able to find it in our neighborhoods, depending on where you live. But like, we are there. They're just trying to suppress us once again.
So that was real serious. So we're going to end this
bit. I'm so sorry.
No, it's great. It's absolutely great, because it also then allows me to end this section on me being a theater nerd as someone who works in the theater for his day job. We all know that Hamilton is, you know, one of the biggest musicals of the past decade, and Alexander Hamilton does indeed appear a couple of times in the book. If there was to be a Baron von Steuben musical, what do you think? Traditional Rodgers and Hammerstein, rock opera of the 70s, some Les Mis era 80s spectacle, something a little more modern?
Oh gosh, you know, I am not the theater queen that I want to be, but I will say that that's such a funny question. You know, Hamilton was a big inspiration for getting people excited about the book. To sell the book, we had to reference Hamilton more than a few times. And there's a whole graphic novel just to talk about Alexander Hamilton's queerness and some of the other founding fathers' queerness. We wanted to put that aside and focus mainly on von Steuben. But I would feel like an off-Broadway musical, kind of like a genetic rock opera? Yeah, Repo, the genetic rock opera, feels kind of right to me, like a small black box theater. He dreamed of all this grandeur and he wanted so much for himself. But I think the truth was he was often the best dressed man in a room full of impoverished Americans. And I think there's a lot of fun to be had in kind of that cross-section. He came from Prussia, which was like this Disney fantasy palace, basically, in a lot of ways. And he ended up in America just slumming it and fighting for a living wage for most of his life.
So beyond Blue Beetle, beyond the Baron, is there anything else coming up that we didn't talk about yet that you want to get a plug in before as we start to wind down?
What's going on? I have a Godzilla short coming out in, I believe, June. It features Mothra versus Hedorah, I'm doing it with my frequent collaborator, Josh Corneone, and we're so stoked. Mothra is our favorite, and Hodora is the perfect Mothra villain. We're kind of stunned that they haven't fought each other before. So that's part of the Godzilla's Rivals series. Hmm. And then I'm doing a Rick and Morty miniseries with my friend Ryan Little, and Jared Williams is drawing it. It's called Rick and Morty Kingdom Balls. It's an elaborate parody of the Kingdom Hearts series and so much more. It starts there, and it just gets weirder and weirder and weirder in the grand tradition of Rick and Morty. So those are the big thing kind of on the horizon. I think that mostly covers it. Blue Beetle's ongoing. So, and our Scarab War collection covering the first arc comes out in August. You can start pre-ordering it now, and I don't have to repeat it, but like, you know how important it is to pre-order these books. They let comic shops know that people are interested. They let bookstores know that people are interested, so they'll up their orders. And, you know, we did okay for single issues for graduation day, but we really hit our stride in the bookstores and in the comic book shops in the collected editions. So I'm hoping we can kind of capture that magic again. Those are the big things coming up. And then hopefully some new announcements before the end of the year.
You mentioned having a dog earlier. Tell us about your dog.
His name is Pretzel. He's a big part of my life. He is a little brown Bristol Griffith Terrier mix and kind of a snaggletooth, but he has so much personality, and he is really like, I post about him so often. People will say things to me like, I was hoping you'd bring your dog to the convention. And it's like, me too, friend. But he would do horrible like that. He's a couch cuddler. He does not want to be in a big crowded convention center.
Speaking of conventions, any upcoming conventions, signings, appearances, anything like that?
Yeah, the big ones I have, I'll be at WonderCon in Anaheim next weekend. That's the final weekend in March. And then beyond that, I think FlameCon is my next convention I'm tabling at. I'll be back in August. I do that every year. It's our 10th FlameCon. So that's a big anniversary for a small con like that. Gets bigger every year. And then I'll be at San Diego Comic-Con in some form. Maybe I'll have some news. We'll see. And then hoping to do New York Comic-Con towards the end of the year. So I think that's it. I just did Awesome Con in Washington, D.C. I'd never done that one before. I had a wonderful time. And then I also did Emerald City Comic-Con, but I was not tabling. I was just wandering around and spending too much money on books.
It's the way to do it. This is a new question I'm trying to start working into the end of the show, but we don't go too long. What is a comic by another creator that you're excited about?
Let's see, another comic that I'm trying to think of something that's been announced. This is an easy one. So Julio Anta and Jacoby Salcedo are doing a Blue Beetle YA graphic novel called This Is Our Land. And it's a totally different outside of continuity take on Blue Beetle. It still features Jaime, Paco, Brenda. It's set in El Paso. And I can't say much more than that. But Julio is such a smart writer, and he always pulls from kind of social issues and contemporary things. And he finds a way to infuse that into the big superhero story. So everything I've seen of it has just been incredible. And I'd encourage anyone who enjoys my Blue Beetle book with Adrian to check out that book when it comes out. I want to say September, October. So Blue Beetle fans are being fed right now, and it's really nice to have multiple takes on the same character at once, because, you know, sometimes these characters sit in limbo for so long, we don't get anything.
Penultimate question. What are you reading right now? Comics, prose, whatever.
Oh, gosh. What am I reading right now? That's a great question. Where's my bookshelf? Okay. I'm reading about, this is a teaser of sorts. I'm reading a lot about paleontology. And that's something that's very unusual for me. And so I'm trying to learn a lot about that and different eras of dinosaurs and where they existed throughout the globe. You know, there are places like Mongolia is kind of like a Wild West for dinosaurs right now, because there used to be these lush tropical jungles there, I guess. And so places like you wouldn't expect, like the American Southwest was obviously a big one in the 1800s. And then like even Transylvania used to be like a dinosaur paradise for millions of years. So I'm interested in dinosaurs right now.
It's like it's like getting to be a 6-year-old boy all over again. What are you into right now?
No, dinosaurs. It really is. No, they teach you about George Washington and dinosaurs when you're six, but they don't tell you the truth. So you have to find it out much later in life.
It's great. Josh, this has been a fantastic time. Final question as we release you back into the world. How can people follow you online and keep up with Blue Beetle and everything else that you got going on?
Yeah, you can find me online at Lost His Keys Man. I lost my keys, man. There's another Josh Trujillo, so he beat me to it. But you can find me there. Or you can find me at my website, joshtrujillo.com, which I don't update enough, so don't look there. But you can follow me there. I'm always on socials, Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky, even Facebook a little bit. So just find me. Find me at the convention. Say hi. Ask about my dog. And I will be all too happy to answer.
Right on. Josh, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No, of course. Thank you, guys.
That's it for this week's show. As a reminder, WMQ&A is part of ComicsXF, where you can find this podcast along with our sister podcasts, Battle of the Atom and Bat Chat with Matt and Will, a Batman ranking podcast co-hosted by Matt Lazowitz and Will Nevin. You can listen to WMQ&A on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Amazon Music, Audible, and at ComicsXF.com, where new episodes move Tuesday mornings. You can support ComicsXF at patreon.com/ComicsXF, where a $1 donation gets you a shout-out at the end of every episode of WMQ&A. A $2 donation gets you early access to WMQ&A and a shout-out at the end of every episode. A $3 donation gets you a sticker, early access, and a shout-out. A $5 donation get you access to our monthly bonus podcast, Our Son Pete, a deep dive into the comic appearances of British mutant super spy Pete Wisdom. A $25 donation lets you request a primer, one of our custom reading guides for a series, character, or creator. And a $50 donation lets you advertise on the show. Big thanks to our patrons, Joel Elod, Shelf Dust, Lisa Slack, Will Redman, Tobias Carroll, Mike Sagawa, Will Nevin, Liz Large, Asimov Fangirl, Carla Pacheco, and Robert Secundus. You're all special, and we love you. You can follow ComicsXF on Twitter at ComicsXF, me at Daniel P. Grote, and Matt Lazowitz at MattLaz1013. You can also follow ComicsXF on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. And until next week, remember, a supervillain once tried to trick Superman and Big Barda into making a sex tape.
WMQA.